Hey everybody, welcome back to 10% True. Just before you get stuck into this episode, I wanted to let you know that in 2024, I'm going to be republishing my book, Red Eagles, America's Secret MiGs. That's the story of the 4477th Test and Evaluation Squadron and the program Constant Peg that exposed American fighter air crew to secretly acquired and operated MiGs in the Nevada desert in the 1970s and 1980s. The book's been out of print for a while. It goes for crazy prices online, but I'll be republishing as a softback exclusively through my website, 10percenttrue.com. If you're thinking about supporting the channel, you'd like to buy the book for yourself or even as a gift, please do go and place a pre-order. I'll put a link in the description. All pre-orders are going to be 25% off, and I'll make sure I personally inscribe and sign your copy for you. Anyway, I'll let you get back on with enjoying this episode. Take care. Hey everybody, welcome back to 10% True and this very special episode courtesy of Authentic Media. Before I tell you about that, let me just give you a quick update about the channel and where I am. I know some of you may not have caught the last podcast that I released, which is actually a live stream, and so therefore may not know that I'm just taking a short break from podcasting at the moment to focus on some book projects. As some of you know, I was formerly an aerospace and defense journalist. Some of my older books are out of print. I'd like to bring them back into print and update them, specifically Eagle Engaged, which was my book that I co-wrote with Disco Dildy about the F-15A through D. That is now 20 years out of date and needs an update. So I will be visiting some F-15 squadrons in the US this summer to fly with them, interview some of the aircrew and maintainers, find out what's changed in the jet since we last wrote that book. And the same for the F-15E. So I will be visiting some guys at Eglin and other bases to get an update on what's happening with the E and to bring that book up to date and republish it. If that interests you, then you can go to 10percenttrue.com and there's a tab in there for books and there's a subscription if you want to get part of the newsletter so that you can find out what's happening. And when these books get released, you can get discounts if you're interested in buying them. So that's what I'm doing. I will be back. Don't worry about it. I will. I've already got four interviews in the can. I've got an F-15E in Desert Storm. I've got an F-4G in Desert Storm. I've got an F-14D Iraqi Freedom. And I've got a Starbaby Pachuca interview that's already taped and two, maybe three more lined up with Starbaby. So I'm coming back. There will be more content. You just have to be patient. In the meantime, you can go and check out Authentic Media's website. These guys commissioned me to do a series on the F-35. I did this interview with a guy called Dave Burke, who's a Marine Corps pilot. He's going to introduce himself in a minute. And I love the interview so much that I asked Authentic if I could put it on this channel. And they were really kind and gracious, and they said I could. So thank you to Authentic Media for allowing me to reproduce this on my channel. And as guests and as listeners, if you think it's a good interview, go and check out Authentic Media and get the other interviews there. The other thing you can do while I'm away is you can go and check out Safe on Deck, the podcast by a Navy pilot who is currently serving in the Navy. He's another, like Authentic Media, another podcaster who I think we are all on the same page in that we allow our guests space and time to talk and to expound. We don't talk over them and we show them the respect to allow them to say their piece without pressuring them to hurry up or to work to a particular timeline. And that's exactly what I've tried to do on 10% True. So those channels are both, or those podcasters are both very heavily in line with the ethos of 10% True. So check them out. Anyway, I'll let you get on with listening to Dave talk about the F-35. I look forward to seeing you soon. Cheers.
Hey everybody, welcome to this Authentic Media podcast special episode on the F-35B. I'm joined today by Dave Burke, and I'm really looking forward to chatting to him about his experiences flying the F-35. Before that, though, just a quick introduction to you, the audience at home, in case you're not familiar. So Authentic Media is running a series on the F-35 aircraft. My name is Steve Davies. I'm usually the host of the 10% True podcast, but I'm in the very fortunate and privileged position to have been invited by them to guest host the F-35 series. And so that's why I'm here. The idea behind this series is not really to be combative or argumentative with the guest and to try and prove a point, but simply to ask questions and then listen to the responses they give. So if there's anybody who's at home who is a vehement critic of the F-35, I hope you forgive me for not being too difficult with my guest today. That's my introduction. Dave, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Steve, it's great to be here. I appreciate the time, man.
Can you tell us, Dave, then, just very briefly, what was your career like in the Marine Corps? Obviously, you were a fighter pilot. What did you fly and for how long and how many hours? What are your credentials?
Yeah, let's see if I can get this right. Drawing back in my memory, I joined the Marine Corps. I started flying. My first fighter was the F-18 Hornet, and I flew F-18Cs. For several years, I was a carrier-based Marine. So as a Marine, I flew off the USS John C. Stennis. I did multiple combat deployments off carriers. And spent the first 4 years of my career flying Hornet off the boat. I then went up to be a Top Gun instructor as a Marine, one of the few Marine pilots on the staff at Top Gun, and did an additional deployment in the Hornet. I know I have over 2,000 Hornet hours in my time flying in the Marine Corps. I was also dual qualified at Top Gun in the F-16. So while I was up at Top Gun, I flew the F-18 and F-16. I have several hundred hours in the F-16, but I cannot tell you exactly how many, but it was during my time at Top Gun as an instructor that I flew that. I then went on to be the only Marine to ever fly the F-22 Raptor. And I flew the Raptor for almost 4 years. I got my initial training at Tyndall, and then was stationed at Nellis Air Force Base at the 422. Again, hundreds and hundreds of hours, but I can't tell you exactly how many hundreds of hours I have flying the F-22 Raptor. And then I became the first operational pilot in the world to fly and be qualified in the F-35B. And I commanded the first F-35B squadron as a Marine Corps squadron commander. Hundreds of hours in that thing, and I don't know how many either. I'm in the 3,000-hour range, probably a little under 3,000 between those four. But I was very fortunate to fly the F-18, the F-16, the F-22, and the F-35, fully qualified and operational, those four jets, which was a pretty cool career. And for anyone really interested, I was also a forward air controller. I spent a year on the ground as a FAC. I was in the Battle of Ramadi in 2006, where I called in a whole bunch of airstrikes and did a bunch of crazy stuff as a Marine forward air controller as well.
Wow. That's a very interesting career.
It was interesting to say the least.
So you haven't had sight of any of the questions I'm going to ask you today. And my method, if you will, at the risk of sounding pretentious, is that I don't really go through and create lists of questions before that I interview. I want them to be organic. But I did know that you flew the F-22 before we started talking. Yeah. And we were very fortunate to have on this channel Press Wheeler, who talked about the F-35A. He was an F-16 guy who then went to the F-35A in the Air Force. And I'm sure there's going to be some crossover between our interviews in terms of asking the questions. It's the same airframe, effectively. I mean, they're slightly different. Missions, different configurations, but same principles underlying. I think what is unique about you then, Dave, certently from this series point of view, is the fact that you have that F-22 experience. And I wanted to start by asking you then, I'm going to put your storytelling skills to the test. Could you tell us the story of 5th Gen then? What is 5th Gen? Why did it come about? Which direction was it headed? What was important about it, or is important about it because it's still current? And what is the story behind it?
Yeah, I really like that question. I don't know if the story of 5th Gen has really ever been told the way it can and needs to be told, partially because of something you alluded to in our preparation for this, is there's a lot that goes on in the 5th generation world that unfortunately we can't be completely open about because there's a lot of information that is essentially not available to the public, which is fine, but it's not a good reason to not be able to tell the story or answer hard questions. So I welcome whatever questions you got. I think if you just think about 5th generation in general, I think the word that almost always comes to mind or top of mind is stealth. And of course, that is an incredibly important attribute, I think for a few very different reasons, but I'll mention them quickly. One is, we have to maintain an advantage over our competitors. And those advantages are typically measured generationally. And so you've got the first generation of fighters became the second generation of fighters, and fighters early on in the 50s and 60s maybe lasted for 5, 10, 15 years. Then you started getting in the 60s and the Phantom lasting for a little bit longer, and third generation fighters. And then you had these fourth generation fighters and these late 70s, 80s vintage fighters that lasted even now, you know, 30, 40, 50 years. And each time we built a generation of fighter, our competitors would eventually match that capability and even start to toy with exceeding it. And we've always tried to push ourselves. And you see these happen in these generational developments. And I think what's unique about the 5th generation, aside from the fact that it's an attempt for us to continue to stay ahead of our peers, is it brought to the fore a tactical stealth platform. Now, for those of us that fly in the fifth generation world or fly fifth generation fighters, we know that stealth is just one of many really important attributes that distinguish fourth generation airplanes from fifth generation airplanes. So if you look at the F-18, F-16, the legacy fighters that I flew, and the F-22 and F-35, to be quite frank, they're much more different than they are similar. And I know fifth generation airplanes can be measured in the same ways: how fast they go, how high they fly, how much gas they have, their weapon payload, G, maneuverability, acceleration, all these ways to measure fighters. If you look at a fifth generation, I think the thing that is, generically speaking, the most important attribute of a fifth generation plane is what it knows, what it understands, what it can see. And the word see is a generic term for the information that it can absorb and process. And now you start to combine a single seat platform that has incredible information capability, and then, of course, great performance, and then the ability to manage itself in airspace that it's typically other fighters are denied the access to that airspace. Now you start to see what the story of fifth generation is. It's not just stealth fighters. It's a range of capability that we never had before in a single seat platform that allows us to do things in places we've never done them against enemies that can't do that. And that's the story of fifth gen, which is now, you know, it's not a brand new story. It's been around for decades now. But that's really my version of that, a very truncated version of the fifth gen story.
Well, that was a very articulate answer. Thank you. I think the question that immediately comes to mind when you describe that philosophy and the design decisions that go into achieving those goals is the question of numbers or sort of quantity versus quality. So,
yeah,
you know, cost comes into it. And again, yep, the cost is changing. I know there's lots of different ways of measuring how much an F-35 sure costs. And I'm not going to go down that rabbit warren. That's for somebody else to go and explore. I wouldn't have the first idea what the right number was. But cost is clearly an issue. And, you know, with yeah platforms like the F-15 EX now coming out and people saying, well, buy more of those, buy fewer F-35s. What is the balance then between quality versus quantity? And I'm thinking, I'm thinking specifically in a scenario, you know, if you took a scenario where we went up in, let's say, the Taiwan Straits, you know, it was against yeah China, you know, China with yeah almost unlimited resources, you know, masses of assets, a logistical chain that is huge that can support the war effort for a long time. Yeah. Where do you strike the balance and how do you strike the balance?
Listen, you're two for two with really good questions. And I think they're important questions to ask, because I think the correct answer when the question of, do you buy a plane in relatively small numbers because it's very expensive because its capability is so high, and then do you balance it with the loss of the mass that you might be able to put forth? And I think I'm going to forget what the quote is, but something about, you know, numbers is
quantity
has a quality in its own right. Yes, I'm like, exactly. And so the answer is embedded into the question is you have to balance that. We certainly need to balance that. The way I always considered thinking about the value of a really expensive plane, and make no mistake, I don't think anybody is going to argue that the F-22 and F-35 are really cheap. It's not, no, you're never going to hear that. Now, the question is whether or not the investment in that money, whether the return on that, whether it's an affordable platform. The question I always wanted to ask myself if I thought about mass of a maybe a less capable platform, like a legacy platform, what I didn't want to ever find myself in a position, what I don't think the country ever wants to find itself in the position of, is that the enemy gets to decide whether or not our equipment is relevant. And so if you build a bunch of airplanes, and I'm being very generic here, let's just say you take a fourth gen platform that doesn't have the attributes of an F-22 and F-35, but it's very affordable from a raw cost perspective. I mean, you could just buy a bunch of them. You might be able to fly those things in a bunch of different conflicts, but we don't get to decide whether that's true. Meaning the threats capability, the threats air defense, the threats, you even refer to logistics and all the supportability, they get to decide whether or not our planes can fly. And I don't like that idea. And so the balance for me weighs very heavily towards the capability and the technology, even if it's more expensive, because we get to dictate when and where we fly those machines and not the other way around. And I would hate to be in a position where, because we wanted to save a little bit of money, and so we bought a quote unquote more affordable platform that had less capability, I think the generic term, like a Gen 4.5, I don't know if that really means anything specific, but an airplane that lacks some of the inherent characteristics of a fifth gen plane, like an F-22 and F-35, certain threats, and you named one of them already, based on their ability, can make a manned fighter like that irrelevant with a snap of a finger. And I don't like that idea. And I don't think we as a country should like that idea. So I think you have to push that needle towards, not pegged in the end, but towards the capability that we have, even though that capability means less overall numbers and higher overall cost. It allows us to dictate the situation rather than the situation being dictated to us. And I think that's very important when you try to predict the future, which I'll describe as simply very unknown. We have to be able to plan for the unknown. And that is a really hard thing to do when it comes to modern 21st century warfare. And one thing that I can assure you is that legacy fighters, fourth generation fighters, non-stealth, non-centrifuge airplanes cannot survive a future conflict. And I don't care how many of them you have.
I noticed you said earlier that you had gone and flown with the 422. And would I be presuming correctly to think that you worked on 4.5 gen integration then when you were flying the F-22 with the 422?
I was fortunate enough to lead the integration test flights that we did as an operational pilot. So I did integration. I think they called it multi-MDS. I'm trying to think of the Air Force term, TMS-MDS. We essentially did the integration tests with every fourth generation fighter we had. So as the Raptor lead, as the test lead for the F-22, I flew with F-15Cs, F-16s, Hornets as well. And so we got to see how integration with fourth and fifth gen fighters work. And I got to see that firsthand as an operational pilot on the F-22. It was great to see what that integration looked like.
I mean, we will get to, if the audience at home is wondering, there really isn't a structure. I don't have a structure for this. So I'm just asking questions as we chat. This is just a conversation effectively, and at home you're listening to it. But I will get to talking about F-35B and talking about the mission and why the Marine Corps needs the airplane, and we'll get to that and we'll explore that. But let me just stick with this for a moment then, because I think this is very interesting. So you've just described how the 4.5 gen, which is an enigmatic term in its own way, would not survive against, you know, sort of peer threats, let's say. And you've led the effort to integrate your fifth gen air dominance fighter with other platforms, your other 4.5 gen platforms. What are the challenges in doing that? I mean, because I guess they would also apply to F-35. What is difficult about getting your F-22 or your F-35 to communicate with, share information with, network with, whatever the verb is, those older platforms, and to get them in the fight and to get them in the fight effectively?
Yeah, it's a fair question. And I think your listeners might understand this. Is one of the things that was the biggest challenge for the F-22 initially is the origin of that design was we really didn't want to share anything with anybody. For what should have be very obvious, it was not some nefarious scheme to isolate us from the world. It was the more information you put out, the more you transmit, the more risk there is of you being discovered. And we wanted to maintain control over all those potential ways to be detected. So when you had this initial iFiddle, this initial communication device that allowed the F-22s to communicate with each other, we really wanted to limit the ability to be exposed to everyone else. And one of the drawbacks to that was, as we started thinking about integrating with fourth generation assets, was, well, it's not that easy. And we had to research a bunch of different offboard sources and different technology solutions. It created a bunch of frustration. There was a lot of comments and commentary around it. But again, all of it was initially designed to just keep the airplane hard to find. And I'm being very generic in that explanation. But anybody that's done any reading on that knows exactly what that is. And that's a very good attribute. But of course, there's a balance there. It comes with some unintended consequences, which is all of a sudden F-16s, F-18s, F-15s, it's harder for us to interact with them. The F-35 as a platform, as a program, understood that, and I think made incredible leaps to be able to manage the internal interaction between F-35 as a platform with each other and receive and transmit information with a bunch of other non-fifth generation platforms, because we figured out a massive need to do that. And so there's a real clear evolution. And I think the F-35 specifically in the fifth gen world, its ability to interact with other platforms is fantastic while still preserving the things that are of a concern. But it is not easy to do by any stretch. My experience with fourth and fifth gen integration in the experience I was telling you about a little bit before in the Raptor was The presence of fifth generation planes really makes fourth generation planes more lethal and more capable. Now, that won't last forever, but it is not just because we're flying around in our fancy stealth airplanes. It's because of the information that we provide. And really, the only takeaway anybody should have from that comment is that there's a lot of really impressive information available to a fifth-gen machine, not by virtue of the fact that it might be stealthy, but that it does a really good job of figuring out what's going on, and people want to know what's going on and share that information. And so the presence of fifth-generation platforms, the value of that should be pretty obvious because everybody wants to fly with a fifth-generation plane out there for those reasons.
You're obviously not going to discuss anything that's classified. I'm not going to ask you for anything that's classified, but could you simplify the interaction between an other the fourth or the 4.5 gen fighters and fifth gen fighters, or distill it down to something as simple as they are sort of the equivalent of AMRAAM shooters that are just going to fly alongside your F-35 or F-22, take the targets from you and target somebody, with AMRAAMs, and then turn around and go and recharge effectively. Is it as simple as that, or is it more sophisticated?
It is more sophisticated than that. That is, I think, appropriate for a particular scenario. The way what you described is not wrong. I don't mean to say that no, that's not correct, but it might represent a slightly more narrow range of use for those fourth generation platforms. In this particular case of, I think you almost described it like a missile truck, which is I'm going to bring them on along with me in certain ways to use what they're carrying that I might not have myself. Certainly a relevant in a particular scenario. Let's see if I can say this clearly and appropriately. The way I, in a fifth generation platform, interact with the fourth generation platform is hard. And I think the point I really want to make is I have to really understand the optimal way for those fourth generation machines to operate in order for me as a fifth generation machine to create an interaction with them that's effective. And my point, I guess, if I can continue to try to say this more and more clearly, it's not as simple as me saying, oh, I'll bring these guys along, put them where I want them to be, use them the way I want to use them for their particular capabilities, because just them being there creates risk for them. And what I need them to do is fly their machines in a really optimized way for their particular platform. So how Eagles fly, how Hornets fly in relationship to each other in three-dimensional battle space is different. They're different airplanes, they have different strengths and weaknesses, and they operate differently. As a fifth-gen pilot, I really need to accommodate that more than them accommodating me. I have much more flexibility than they do. So it's not as simple as I need their missiles, come hang out on my wing or go in this particular area and I'll tell you what to do. Because that actually might create a bunch of risk for them because they shouldn't or can't or effectively be where I think on paper they should be. So it's a lot more nuanced than what you described. Again, your scenario isn't wrong by itself, but I think that probably represents a relatively narrow set of how we would interact together. And it's a lot more nuanced based on mission and a whole bunch of other things. And probably the biggest driver of that is what we got to at the very beginning. The biggest driver of all that is the threat. But I think it's important too. The threat isn't just how good the bad guy's airplane is. The threat is their entire integrated defense system, all the assets available to them to find and locate and employ against us. Like, we have to understand that whole spectrum of capability. And it's not just do they have a really nice enemy platform, a fighter flying against us. It's much more difficult and much more nuanced than that.
Well, that might be a good point then to ask you what the intention was or is for the Marine Corps to be flying the F-35B. So when I talked to Press Wheeler about the F-35A, he said that the stated mission or the primary mission for the F-35A and Air Force Service is SEED, is to go after the integrated air defense system of the adversary. Is it the same for you guys in the Marine Corps? Or have you got a different mission set for it?
I mean, yes and no. And so you already said it very well. If you look at the F-35 A, B, and C, they're much more similar than they are different. Of course, there are differences. And the most obvious ones are where they can get on and off platforms, can they get on a ship, and the carrier variant, and the stowable variant. There's some very clear, noticeable things in how they take off and land that are super obvious. But inside that machine, they're all very similar. So the overlap in those capabilities is super significant. I think the B variant specifically, and it is not without a ton of controversy, as you know, and I was right there in the middle of it being on probation, all these frustrations they had around the B. I think what the Marine Corps envisioned and what the Marine Corps needed and demanded and really forced into existence, which I applaud, is a machine that could operate essentially in any environment, to include a whole bunch of unknown environments in a way that no other platform could. And so you have this airplane that has this sensor ability. The A, B, and C from a sensor standpoint, they're all almost identical. There's a couple of very small differences. But for the most part, what it sees, what it knows, what it talks about, and what it shares, all very, very, very similar. So you've got this incredibly high situational awareness machine that does an amazing job integrating with all these other assets that are out there. But the B can literally almost go anywhere. Almost anywhere. And rather than say, where should it go and where do we envision it flying and what can you expect? The Marine Corps had this idea, and the Marine Corps has lived by this mantra forever, which is we need to be most prepared when the nation is least prepared. We need to be the most capable when everybody else is the least capable, which means we need to be in a position by which we never have to come back and go, oh, hey, I'm sorry, but that threat environment is way harder than we expected. It's way more challenging than we anticipated. We can't operate there. And planes like the F-18 and the Harrier are at a point where, like I said earlier, the threat could dictate to us with a flip of a switch whether or not we could fly. Marine Corps said, I want a plane that can operate in any environment, in any threat scenario, in almost any piece of terrain, whether it's floating or land-based, and be able to get our machines in and out of there. And so in the Marine Corps, it isn't just the F-35B by itself. It's also the helicopters, the Ospreys, the logistics, the support, the weapons, the Marines, the fuel, all these different components have this vision of this highly mobile, this highly flexible force that could fly in places that nobody else could in anticipation of the unknown threat environment. And I think that's the brilliance behind it. Of course, that invites a bunch of controversy because it's different. And we don't always get to see that reveal itself. Oftentimes they go, well, you know, the B's got less gas and less payload than the A. And I can't say, well, you know, you never know what might happen. It's a really hard argument to make. The Marine Corps fully understood, and the F-35 community, especially the B community, still understands it's just a matter of time where we need that airplane to fly in places it's never flown before. And only one variant can do that.
I'd like to explore with you the period of time where you were you had a seat to watch the probationary period of the airplane. Oh, yeah. and that experience.
A front row seat.
But before we do that, let me just pick up on a couple of other little things that I think would also be interesting to explore then. So could you narrow down then the answer to some specifics in terms of, would you be expecting, because I'm not a naval warfare expert, so, and I don't know much about the Marine Corps, but I think when I think of the Marine Corps, I think of beachhead landings. You know, I think that kind of thing. So are you specifically thinking about scenarios where you're in a non-permissive environment, so there's a strong or a capable air defense network that's covering that particular beach, let's say, and you're supporting some grunts who are sort of, you know, in motorized infantry landing vehicles sort of storming the beaches. Yeah. Is that the kind of thing you're thinking of?
Yeah. And again, I think now that represents a mindset that the Marine Corps has that I don't think should be limited to just the physical, in a literal sense, a physical beachhead where naval vessels get to a place where, you know, they go from ship to shore. Now, I don't mean to demarginalize that. That is an incredibly important capability. But I think the Marine Corps sees, if you take the concept of a beachhead, and I'm not an expert in those operations either. By no means am I some brilliant naval tactician. I just think of it in these terms of the way I was always trained and taught is the beautiful thing about the amphibious landing is that we carve out a piece of terrain that essentially is either neutral or belonging to the enemy, and we take it from them. We take it through the aircraft, the equipment, the vessels, the Marines, all that capability. And we create a little area that we can push on into land that we can occupy. And what that allows for is follow-on operations that continue to grow and expand. And we push from the shore all the way into whatever area we might want to operate. All I would translate that into 21st century warfare, which, by the way, that's still true. I don't mean to say no longer the case. But think of any denied area, whether it's a physical beachhead, like a literal, you know, shore to ship transition, I'm sorry, sea to land transition, or any place that's denied that we have minimal access to, we have to have something that breaks into that denied area, wherever that might be. And sometimes that's a break in that we need to break into that with access of information, access of what we see. Maybe we don't even physically land there, but we need to penetrate into areas that might be hard to imagine in our minds. You know, even think of like the cyber world, the idea of penetrating into areas that are owned and occupied by a threat, that's almost metaphorical now. Like it almost applies anywhere. It doesn't just have to be that one environment. As relevant as that environment is, the great thing about the F-35, A, B, or C, or any fifth generation platform is it allows us to penetrate into areas that are might be currently exclusively owned by the enemy. Then we're going to take some of that from them. And once we get a little penetration into that world, we get to start advancing into that and taking that over piece by piece. Something needs to break into that. And that's one of the things to see the platform, what it's supposed to be designed to do in the 21st century, on top of what you just described, which is also true in a literal sense of that amphibious force taking out a beachhead, occupying enemy terrain that over time becomes more and more and more ours as we get to that objective. Not wrong, not untrue, but it's more than just that.
Do you expect, or were you, because you're no longer in the Marine Corps, you've retired, but were you expecting, or do you expect, if you're thinking about future conflicts, a CAS, a close air support type role for the airplane then? And what does that look like? I mean, I was reading some critique of the airplane a while back that was saying one of the things about it is that it, you know, it's got a pretty good sensor suite, but you'd have to get really close to a tank, let's say, or a bunker or something on the ground, and then you'd have to fly away from it to get back into a position where you could come back and attack it. And that's not what you would have maybe if you were flying an AV-8B or certainly not an A-10, which are traditional, let's say, CAS platforms for the Marine Corps and the Air Force, respectively. But what does that CAS mission look like then on an F-35B? What are its... again, you're not going to give any secrets away, but what are the things that are good about it, and what are the things that are challenging about it?
Yeah, and again, a perfectly fair question, because you certainly look at something like an A-10. I mean, you can't ask for a better close air support platform than that. I mean, it's an unbelievable machine. I told you I was a forward air controller, and I was very fortunate. Now, I worked almost exclusively with Marine Corps assets, although I did work with Air Force assets as well. So I got a really good flavor of what it's like to be on the ground, needing those airplanes overhead. In terms of employment, I think at the time, certainly what was being carried in Iraq when I was there, I had controls of everything that the F-18, the Harrier, the Huey, and the Cobra carried as a standard conventional load during my time there. You know, from Type 1 gun runs to Type 3 on an AC-130 and everything in between. So I'm a believer in CAS, and I'm a believer in those conventional platforms and how completely effective they are. One of the challenges when thinking about F-35 CAS, and I absolutely see that as a potential mission, is I think the way most people look at things is they take a traditional template of what things look like. They take this new machine and stick it in an old template and go, well, it's more cumbersome and it doesn't seem to work quite as well. And it seems to have less time on station and less orbit. It's all true. But when I think about what close air support might look like, all I want to think about in my mind is the whole objective of close air support, especially when you're talking about this detailed coordination that's required to conduct CAS between the people on the ground, the FAC, the JTAC, and the ground troops, and the aircraft overhead, is I have to be in a position by which those airplanes can support me. And what the F-35 should consider itself as one of the requirements for that mission is there ever a situation where the threat prevents us from operating inside there? And if the threat doesn't really prevent us from operating, if the threat really is low, it's a highly permissive environment, then what you might get is a plane that has a little less loiter time, a little less time on station, might be a little more cumbersome. First of all, the pilots are going to be trained extremely well. They're going to be able to do that mission. You know, a fully configured F-35, when it's not worried about the permissiveness of the environment and carries a bunch of external stores, that thing is going to be awesome. It's going to carry a bunch of great ordnance. It's going to be able to do a bunch of cool missions. Would I compare it to an A-10? No, I wouldn't even think about comparing it to an A-10, because what I'm trying to figure out is what does CAS look like in 2034 for kids that are in kindergarten right now that might be calling in close air support in an environment by which traditional airplanes can't operate. That close air support is going to look different. But what's going to be required is a highly detailed integration and coordination between the people on the ground and the people in the air. And what the people in the air can never say is, oh, I can't do that. It's not safe for me to do that. I can't operate in this environment. And so in that regard, all I would offer is we want to break our traditional template of what close air support looks like and have the F-35 fit in a different paradigm, because if I'm comparing legacy operations to future operations, I'm taking the known with the unknown. And I think that's a really hard thing to do. And if you take that known and unknown, on paper, you want an airplane that has the broadest number of weapons, the broadest range of weapons, the most amount of gas, all those, that's what you want. The problem with that is that that answers yesterday and today's question, does not answer tomorrow's question. And I think the F-35 community, especially in the Marine Corps, where CAS is a primary function, they're wrestling right now with how are we going to conduct CAS in an environment by which Marines on the ground in close contact with the enemy are at risk of losing their position without my help, and the threat carries with it a defense system that nullifies the abilities of the Hornets, the Harriers, and the A-10s of the world. How do we respond to that? That's the question that we have to ask. CAS is absolutely a mission set that's going to occur. What and how it looks like, I don't know, but I can almost guarantee you it won't look anything like it does now. And if it does look it does now, we're totally fine. We're totally fine, because now is a totally permissive environment. We're really good at that. And the F-35 can fill that mission in a way that's going to support the Marines on the ground. And they'll be fine. May not look exactly how they want, may not how it does now, may look different, but they're going to be totally fine in that environment.
I think that is a very interesting answer, because it also makes me wonder about other elements of warfare. So you have described at the beginning the fifth gen story ultimately was about, you know, low observability, but also equipping the airplane with the ability to understand the environment around it, to be able to process a bunch of things and then present it to you as the battle manager and decide what you want to do, how you want to run the fight. One of the guests that I have on my channel, 10% True channel, is Mike Petrucca, Starbaby. He was a former Air Force colonel, electronic warfare officer, F4G guy. A very, very engaging, very interested guy, but a very ardent proponent of electronic warfare as a specialist skill, and somebody who decries the Air Force's decision to deconstruct the electronic triad in the 90s. So to pursue stealth in favor of F4G, EF-111, and to a lesser extent I can't remember what it was, Compass called C-130. I don't remember which one it is. I can't remember the designation for it. EC-130.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe I think you got it right. Yep.
So he talks a lot about that, and he's a vocal critic of F-35 in some respects. In other respects, he gives it his due. But he talks about electronic warfare as a sort of an art that the Air Force at least has just dumped back with the Navy, which goes back to Vietnam days. You know, in the Vietnam days, they let the Navy do that. HARM, for example, as a Navy program. You know, that came out of the Navy's thinking, not the Air Force's. So, you know, you can look at the history and understand that. But what I'm curious to understand is whether or not, now, you, as a very experienced fifth-gen guy, then, believe that the EW side of that equation is also being taken care of. I mean, is there a sort of, let's say, an imbalanced emphasis on the LO piece without a similarly balanced emphasis on the EW?
Yeah, well, in reverse order, that question that he's asking, and that name rings a bell. I can't place it specifically, but I know that name when you said it. And anybody that's thinking about our operations in the electromagnetic spectrum, wherever it might be, those are good questions. He should be asking those questions. He should be telling other people to be thinking about it. So I applaud that concern. I obviously don't have the history of EF-111, Prowler, RF-4, what you described. He must have a much better encyclopedia of information on that. But the fact that he's asking that question is a really good question to ask. And platforms, any platforms that we have, that should be a consideration. Because when I've said it several times, when we talk about what the future of warfare might look like, and by the way, it's a guess. We don't know. We simply do not know. It would be crazy to not consider that being a massive consideration the operations in that spectrum, the electronic warfare spectrum. And that's, again, a very generic term. He's probably much more educated than I am on the details, but I think it's fully appropriate to ask that question. And you could look that in both in an offensive and defensive capability, electronic attack and electronic protection, and maybe even just some passive surveillance, just figure out what's going on in things other than the visible spectrum with your eyeballs or the RF spectrum with your radar. And what I can, man, again, you're asking really good questions. I got to be a little bit careful with the answer, sure. But I would just say this. One of the things that I think is most remarkable about the F-35, which is unique from Raptor and anything else, is the range of spectrum that it operates in, infrared, laser, electro-optical, radio frequency, the range of spectrums that it interacts with, and the range of platforms it can give and receive information to, I think at least demonstrates at a minimum, it's a huge consideration. To say that we've mastered that or we've got everything, no, I wouldn't say that. But if you take a look at some of these big RF platforms, especially when I talk, talking like big Air Force, these large, in a literal sense, these large platforms that must cover a much wider range than any particular tactical airplane, in an F-35 now, you actually have overlap with a whole bunch of places and different spectrums you never had in any of their airplanes. But it's also wrapped up in a package that can go all the way to the other end of the spectrum, which is it can do day VMC, low threat casts, with bombs hanging on pylons, and also full anti-access aerial denial, fifth generation only warfare. And I think the fact that you've got this incredible interest in electronic capabilities, both offensive and defensive, inside a platform, a quote tactical platform, which really isn't tactical, by the way. I think it's strategic. That's another question for another time. But I think it at least serves to answer that as an absolute consideration. It should continue to be consideration. And I think it's central to feeding, which I think is the most important attribute in warfare, which to me is situational awareness. Of all the things that are important to the warfighter, information, And what I mean by that is knowing what's going on is by far the most important thing. You can give me all sorts of weapons. You can give me all sorts of on paper capabilities, a bunch of gas, a bunch of bombs. You can give me a bunch of whatever. If I don't know what's going on, it's not all that helpful. In fact, I'd give you back a little bit of gas if I got a whole bunch of information in return. And information, part of that of that spectrum of information is that electronic warfare spectrum, which he's spot on, is a huge consideration.
I wanted to ask then, you mentioned about one of the Marine Corps' raison d'etre is to be able to go somewhere where nowhere else can go. You're on the amphibious landing craft or whatever they're called, and you're going and doing this thing that no one else can do. One of the criticisms that you hear about F-35, and I don't think it's changing, is the logistics chain, the complexity of it, the mission capable rate of the airplanes themselves. I mean, I understand they have a pretty good set of radar cross-section reduction materials on them, so they don't sort of weather like the F-22 does or the B-2 that has to be kept indoors or under a cover, whatever. So I understand that they fare quite well at sea. But what about logistics then? Because if you're going to be going on a relatively small boat, ship, whatever it's called, and there are a few of you, you probably don't have too much room for spares. How reliable is the airplane? Have you seen a trend in changing reliability? And what are the issues that you saw as an aviator with logistics?
Again, a massive consideration. The ability to sustain and maintain a platform for whatever its capability is goes well beyond just what's in between the nose and the tail of the fighter as it gets on board a ship or on an austere base or a foreign operating base, whatever it might be. I've got to support that thing. And obviously, generationally, you just named three different platforms. You had a little bit of a B-2 reference there. You had an F-22 reference in there, an F-35 reference in there. That the F-35 represents, I think, some major technological leaps and just operational capability and just in terms of maintaining the stealth aspect of a plane and supporting that in normal operations. You're on a ship, you're taking panels off, you're working on airplanes, you're in this crazy environment, and you don't want an airplane that's super delicate. You want a tough airplane that can deal with very harsh environments. Certainly the F-35 is better than any of its predecessors. I also think that is a continued work in progress. The amount of effort I saw and interest I saw in my career, I know it's continued now that I'm out, into the development and growth of our logistic and support ability is pretty profound. And it's, I'm sure it's not cheap. I couldn't tell you any real numbers, but I know it's a major investment, and that has to be balanced with everything else. So the short answer is it's way better. And then the longer answer is there's a lot of complexities to making it even better, as good as it needs to be, especially something you imagine is going to be sustained for decades on end. We're going to have this airplane for decades and decades, and we need this thing to be capable operating in all these different environments. The ship, life at sea is unforgiving. It's demanding. It's a brutal work environment, and it's brutal on the machines and certainly on the people. And so the development of understanding how we work there over time, I would say again, is certainly a work in progress. I think we've certainly gotten better at it, but that also, I think, represents a hugely important question, is when you talk about what you're investing your time and money and capability in, not much different from the previous question you just asked. Not only is it important, I think the platform represents a massive leap in recognizing how important that is. Much to say, like I said, with the EW question you just asked me a minute ago, is talk to the guys from a capability standpoint. The guys who went on the very first carrier deployment, the guys who went on the first small deck carrier deployment, the guys who went on the first overseas deployment, and now go into the most recent years. You know, I don't know to what degree this is open forum, but I think it's out there. Go look at how well the Israelis did in the use of their fifth generation planes in recent years. Just their mission capability rates. How are they doing? They're flying this airplane, you know, all the time. Anybody that's using this plane the way it's intended, the more current it is, the more demand that's been placed on it, the better the airplane has performed. You start going back to 2010, 2012, 2013, 2014. Of course, the FMC rates were low. It was a brand new airplane with hardly any logistics support behind it, and it was the most pioneering aircraft ever created. Now you start talking about what the airplane is due, the most recent lot airplanes, the most recent deployments, and the growth curve on capability is pretty impressive. There's still plenty of a long way to go to get to where it wants to be. You have to look at this thing in a time span of what is this plane going to look like over its 50 plus year life? The F-16 turned 50 a couple weeks ago. 50! Yeah. And I only shudder at wondering, I remember looking back in the early 80s, the problems the Hornets had, the late 70s, the problem the F-16s had. And with time and evolution and improvement, these things get better and better with time. And the F-35 is really no different. Big challenges when it was developed, big challenge with initial capability, big challenge in the first couple deployments. And it seems like every time that thing does something, it gets better at it and more capable and more efficient. And the people involved in it get happier and happier with it. And I would just think the growth of that and the curve of that just over the lifespan of that jet just gets better and better over time. That's all it's done. Every time it's been put in a new environment, it's just performed better than it has in the past. And that's the story of fighter aviation. That's exactly what happens. It's hard at first. Things don't work the way you want. You learn a bunch of things. The cool thing is this is in the hands of the operator, and the operator understands better than anybody. The maintainer aboard a ship, the pilot in an austere environment, those are the people that understand what needs to get done. And I think that's why of late the F-35 has performed so incredibly well in these really difficult environments to include combat, which is the best part of the story, is how well it's performed in difficult places.
Let's explore that a little bit then in terms of maturity curve. And certainly from the F-35A perspective, they had Block 3F, I think, was the block where they were going to go IOC with it. And up until that, you know, the aeroplane had, obviously it's all classified, so I don't know exactly what it had, but it had certain capabilities. It didn't have other capabilities. So there were some obvious things like, I don't think it could shoot the gun until one of the later blocks or one of the later software builds. You know, so it wasn't really, you know, it was kind of like flying a toy aeroplane around the circuit because it couldn't really do anything. It certainly wasn't ready to go to war. What was the F-35B's journey like then in that respect? What did it look like?
Putting on my hat, trying to remember when we did an IOC and FOC and what the capabilities were. My only recollection of that is not too much. The three platforms, the three services had slightly different timelines, but ultimately the software progression was the same. We might have been a little off sync of who got 3F first, and I don't remember exactly the details, but we're all, you know, relatively on similar timelines. I think the Marine Corps was happy to IOC. We IOC'd a 2B jet, so it had less capability. Maybe the only thing that's worth recalling that's relevant to the question is, along with each of those upgrades, those software upgrades from 2B, 3i to then 3F, and then what block 4 and beyond look like. Associated with each one of those was a deficiency list. All the things that we were supposed to have that we didn't have, and I think that's what you might be referencing. And even currently today, you know, 2024, there's a deficiency list in what we want in this block, what's funded, what's there, how is it performing. What my recollection was, and I remember looking at the deficiency lists in the platform, software platform that I flew and the different software changes I went through, is all those deficiency lists helped us understand what everybody was trying to figure out, was what was wrong with the airplane and what needed to get better. Sometimes those deficiency lists end up living their own lives or getting out in the world by which they represent some sort of failure of the platform. Even the guys that create the deficiency list would tell you, like, they don't have to represent a failure of the platform. It just represents the current capability versus the desired capability or the funded capability or the demand of that. If it's on a deficiency list, it's us saying, hey, this isn't as good as it needs to be. And I never saw the gap between what we were supposed to have versus what we did have. And there was a gap there, but it was never as bad as people made it out to be. I remember getting the first list of, I think for block 3F, the shortfalls of, I remember some list of, like, I'm making up a number, like 26 deficiencies. And they were like low tier, mid tier, or high tier deficiencies. Or everyone represented what everybody knew, which was, hey, this needs to get a little bit better. And we'd work with the engineers, we'd work with the software developers, we'd work with the contractors. I would embrace the idea that every block that we're going to get, there's going to be a deficiency list that the testing world and the engineering world develops behind that. But I think there's a lot more synergy between the people that created the deficiencies and the people that are building and flying the airplane. There's a lot more synergy there than I think people think. I think oftentimes people look at that like there's one side of the fence saying this thing's all messed up, here's everything wrong with it. The other side of the fence saying, no, everything's perfect. It's not like that. When you're flying the airplane, nobody is more invested in correcting the deficiency of the platform than the human beings inside the machine. Nobody's more invested in that. It would be really dumb for me to know that there might be something wrong with my jet that's underperforming, and then me flying around in the airplane pretending like it doesn't exist. And so I think what's really happening in the platform, it's always been like this, it may just be some of a misunderstanding, is the deficiency world, the people looking at the deficiencies, which is what their job is, and the people looking at the operational capability, we love working together with each other. We want to hear from them what they think is right or wrong and their perspective on that. No different from, I think, any other place where you're looking for gaps to improve in anything. And so there is nowhere near as an antagonistic relationship as it might feel, because I think sometimes when these deficiency lists get published, they're often used as evidence for a platform that's not capable, which is not how I would, that's not how I ever saw it as a pilot in the machine. It's not how I saw it as a commanding officer. It's not how I saw it as anybody in the community, which it was just, here's what needs to get better on that. And you take those efficiencies, you address them, and you improve them. Sometimes it turns out the plane overperforms in some areas. And sometimes you recognize that the deficiencies really don't matter. Like, hey, it's not meeting the spec for this particular capability. And go, well, that's okay. It's actually doing everything I need. And so all those things are just, they're much more geared towards helping us just figure out what needs to get better in the airplane. And it's much less about what's wrong with the airplane. And I feel sometimes when you look at the gaps in those capabilities, especially based on the software, people look at it like, see, it's proof the airplane's not very good. And that's not what those lists do, nor does it reflect any type of animosity between the testers and evaluators and the flyers. There's much more synergy there and much more common interest than it might appear. I love seeing what somebody thought might be wrong with the airplane, because it helped me figure out how to make it better. Sometimes we can make it better very, very easily. Sometimes we couldn't make it better at all. But those lists and those deficiency identification is how the platform grows. It's exactly the tool that we use, but the people creating it aren't trying to prove that there's something wrong with the machine. They're just saying this is what needs to get better.
Yeah, I think the Government Accounting Office, the GAO, is the body that publishes those, and they're used typically by the media to make a point, aren't they? So what you're saying tallies totally with what I've seen. So,
and to that point, like, the government should get what they're paying for. It's a totally fair. It's a totally fair thing. And so I don't look at, you know, the GAO says, here's five things that aren't meeting the specification that we demanded from the contractor. I love the idea of the government holding a contractor accountable. I think it's what it should be. That doesn't necessarily translate to me as a in the cockpit of a plane saying, oh, my plane is no longer capable of flying in this mission. Like, they're two very different things. The tool to demand the investment being delivered on us is a great thing. But the list of deficiencies somehow created its own life by which the detractors of the platform started using it as evidence of a substandard machine. And it's just not right. It's just not it's not what that is designed to do. Of course, there are things with the airplane that need to get better. Of course, there are deficiencies. Every airplane going through a development like that has that. The F-35 is no different. And we want all the capability that we pay for and all the capability we might need. But I think the antagonistic nature of that, I think it's a fabrication of reality. It's very different than it is in the inside world, which is, yeah, we're struggling here. This isn't working. We can't deliver this on time. You don't have this capability. And this is the things we need to do to mitigate that and fix that versus, look, it didn't meet this specification, which means the plane doesn't work. This is not accurate.
I think this is an interesting juncture to ask you a question. I said right at the beginning that I don't sit down and ponder the questions. I treat this as an exercise, as a conversation. That's what we're doing. But there was one question I was going to ask you. It's why I knew you'd flown the F-22. And that was because I listened to the interview between you and Pierre Spray, which was,
I think
2016 or 2017, something like that. I think you were still in, or you were just about to get out, maybe. But it was a while ago.
You're right in the time frame, yeah.
And Pierre has died, and so I'm cautious that dead men have no right of response. So I don't want to be tarnishing his name or anything. But I was aghast at that interview at some of the things he said to you, and saying that you were in the pocket of the defense contractors, and that's why. And I thought I was just angry for you, and I don't even know you, and I just thought that's just a revolting viewpoint and a revolting response to have to somebody who says something that you don't agree with. But the question I wanted to ask you, Dave, was what was that interview like, and what do you make of those very old school, very opinionated, sort of Vietnam era, sort of 70s, 80s era analysts, in inverted commas? Because, he was, he worked, I think, with Tom Christie and Boyd, and I think he had some credentials, but he was talking about, it being a massive mistake and you should buy MiG-21s or whatever. It was just crazy. But so what did you make of that argument? Where do you think that comes from? I mean, is there any credence to any of the things that he was saying?
Well, listen, again, you're asking great questions, and I really appreciate I'm pulling into the memory banks. I certainly remember that interview, and it was contentious. First of all, he's a really nice guy. We talked before and after, very friendly person. And in his defense, he just had very strong opinions, which I fully understand. And I think his investment, his objective investment in his opinion was he cared about the defense of the nation. And so in one sense, we had very common ground. And even the folks that I think would be considered big detractors of the platform, he being one of them, and those that are huge proponents of the platform, me being one of them, if you really think about it, and we really climb high enough, we actually are very aligned in the goals that we have. We care about having a capable defense ability, aviation and otherwise. And so in some sense, like, he and I see the world the same way. We want the best plane for the money and for the job and for the future. And so I don't hold any ill will towards him. And like you said, he's since passed. I think he's got a long record of certainly service to the nation. I do hold the opinion that his viewpoint on fifth generation was wrong. I mean, but not in an antagonistic way. I do remember him saying things like, he made some allusions, like, I think he said something to the effect of, like, the Marines aren't telling the truth, they're hiding. And I was like, man, and I at least in my mind, I'd like to think I handled that well, and I don't think I reacted to it over emotional. But I think I made some comment like, if you think you can get a Marine Corps Lance Corporal to lie to protect his bosses at the Pentagon, like, you don't know Marines very well. Marines are some of the most they might not be they might not have the we don't have the best vocabularies. But we're pretty honest people for the most part. You get a young Marine out there, you ask him his opinion, he's going to give it to you, unfiltered or otherwise. And so I think there was a part of that of, hey, there's a lot of fair criticisms of the platform. There are, to this day, there are fair criticisms of the F-35. And the F-35 community has an obligation to the nation to respond to those criticisms to make sure the country, which is making a massive investment in their tax dollars into the defense of the country, gets an appropriate answer more than, oh, it's just classified, I can't tell you. That is not good enough. And I always advocated as really at the time, I was essentially the spokesperson for fifth generation flying for the Marine Corps, because I was the only pilot in the world at the time that flew Rackers and F-35s, and I was a squadron commander. And what I encourage all my people to do is tell the truth. The truth is the plane is a remarkable machine. And we did not articulate and communicate very well what it was designed to do, what we were capable of doing. And I think if you take a legacy perspective and you stick the F-35 in there and measure that, it creates a whole bunch of risk. The risk that it creates is that it undermines what the future of warfare might look like. And the most obvious one is you look at a measurement of maneuverability. And you think, oh, this airplane is slower than its predecessor, so it must not be as good. And if your only viewpoint is a vintage view of how airplanes interact with each other, and really, for the most part, in his upbringing, you think about Boyds of the 50s. These are brilliant guys, by the way. I'm a huge fan of Boyd. There's no criticism of that. You think about the world they grew up in, the paradigm they grew up in was our two machines are fighting against each other, and the winner is the guy that gets behind the other guy at 1,500 feet and shoots a missile or a gun at him. That, first of all, not only was it true then, it represents an ability that you want to have that ability, but it is such an incredibly narrow way to view an airplane. And I think the trap that Pierre Spray fell into was he wanted to measure the F-35 using the same metrics that he measured an F-16 or an F-18 or an F-15. And the way you measure an airplane, at least a legacy mindset, is how many G's does it pull? How fast does it climb? How much gas does it hold? And then how long can you stay in the airspace? How many weapons can you hang on the wings? All measurements that were relevant, but none of them tell the tale of what I need my airplane to do. And the way I would always try to combat that is I would take a fighter pilot from a platform in the last 50 years, to include these legacy platforms, F-15s, F-16s, whatever, the platforms that were really pioneered in Pierre Spray's day, when you think about at the time the F-16, and there's a little iron in the F-16, is these guys are big F-16 advocates because it was a single mission DVFR fighter that has become the most multi-mission, multi-role, multi-capability machine in the world. And so there's some irony in that argument, which was you needed a single purpose platforms. Like the F-16 does literally every possible mission that's out there. The last thing it is a single seat day VMC, you know, dogfighter. But I digress. The point I really wanted to make was, if you measure it in those regards, what you're going to end up getting is a comparison between these two different things like speed, G maneuverability. And if you compare one to the other, you're going to find deficiencies in this new platform. If you were to ask, to complete that thought, any pilot in the last 50 years, and you were to say, take a pen, go to the whiteboard and write down all the attributes that exist in aviation. And I already talked like speed, G, maneuverability, climb, fuel, weapons. You could start writing all the things that an airplane has in its inherent attributes. And fighters have multiple attributes. Some are really good turning capability and they have very short amount of gas. And you were to then rank order the relevance of all those attributes. Put in order, what's the most important to the least important? And you were to ask a pilot, tell me the most important thing for you to be successful in a platform, the most important attribute, the number one important attribute. I would bet that 100% of pilots would say the most important thing for you to be successful in warfare is situational awareness. That's the most important thing. Meaning if you gave me a platform that was slightly deficient, and the F-18, F-16 argument is a great argument because they're pretty similar planes, but the F-16 had more thrust. It was more powerful. I flew the F-16. It's a more powerful jet than the F-18, and it pulls more Gs. Now, it wasn't quite as nimble, and it didn't have as much maneuverability, whatever. It had strengths and weaknesses. If you were to tell me if I'm going to go to war in an airplane, and I say, you're going to give up your situational awareness for more Gs, there's not a pilot in the world that would do that. In fact, you'd say, hey, I'll trade you a G and a half, and I'm going to give you, you know, X number of more information of what's going on. You know where the enemy is, what they're doing, what they're saying, where they're flying. The most important attribute in the world of warfare, especially aerial warfare, is situational awareness. If you know what's going on, you are going to be much more successful than if you have no idea what's going on and you have a lot of bombs or a lot of gas or you can go really fast. And I used to tell him, like, hey, you show me the enemy that you show me the threat that's flying the fastest against an F-35, and I'll show you the one that's going to die the first. Because if you come out at me and you're flanker mod and you're doing Mach 2 and I'm an F-35, I need to kill that guy first. So all these attributes of speed, all these legacy attributes, I don't mean to say that they're irrelevant. They just don't fit into what's most important. And because the information available to you in an F-35 is so prolific and so shareable, it's the attribute everybody wants. And what oftentimes people get their head wrapped around is, well, how many rounds does it have on the gun? It's like, who cares? If you don't know what's happening, what good did all those bullets do? I will trade you 500 bullets of my cannon for situational awareness, because now I could take the relatively less capability in the number of rounds and make them count much more. And so when I think about the thing that matters the most and the plane that has it the most, the capability of F-35 so vastly exceeds anything else that's flying. If you don't have a sense of the information available to you in a fifth generation plane, it's almost impossible for you to make a fair comparison. And I think what he was saying, I don't think it was the MiG-20. I think he wanted to buy like F-5s or F-20s or something like that. And to me, that goes back to the earlier thing about mass versus, capability. I cannot imagine thinking of going to war in the next 10 years, being in an airplane that people could see, and an airplane of which I couldn't see other people. I could not imagine going into a fight where I did not know what was happening. It'd be the worst possible scenario for me, is I have all these muscles, I have all these weapons, I have all these G's available to me, all this thrust, and I don't know what's happening. And that's, I think, what he misunderstood, and I think that's a generational challenge, is everybody wants to compare the F-35 to the F-16 because that's what it's replacing. They want to compare it to the A-10 because that's what's replacing. But that's not what we're doing. And I think that's a really hard thing to explain, a hard thing to understand. And of course, in the end, the dogfight, the BFM, the one against one dogfighting, is the distillation of an airplane's capability, and it's the most obvious way to experiment, which is, if you and I fight, who knocks the other one out? That means I'm a better fighter than you. And even that explanation is so much more nuanced than that. And I think the F-35 community has to do a better job of explaining what warfare really looks like. And unfortunately, it doesn't look like what it did in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And even when you started getting in the 80s, where you had good information and radars and good, it's what do you do with that information? Who do you give that information to, and what can we do with it on the three-dimensional battlefield? It's a hard thing. Not to speak ill of Pierre Spray, that was his viewpoint, that was his perspective, that was his paradigm, and it was unfortunately just not relevant to the 21st century.
Well, that's a very enlightening answer. Very, very enlightening. You talked about risk. One of the things that I think about when I think F-35, particularly now, as the number of export customers grows and the list expands, and I look at some of the nations that are going to buy it, and I'm thinking that's it's curious that we as in the multinations that contribute to it, but of course it's an American program. We're going to sell it widely. When you talk about F-22, I think you said right at the beginning it was designed to keep itself to itself, and that was not just in terms of its operations, but also export sales. Japan wanted it. They were told you can't have it. It's never been exported, and there are some pretty obvious reasons why you would not want to export it. Conversely, F-35 has been built from the ground up to be exportable. I wondered just, from the perspective of just a run-of-the-mill fighter pilot, not trying to make a political point or be statesmanlike or anything like that. How do you feel about the expansive list of export customers for F-35? What does that say to you? And is it designed in such a compartmentalized way that as an American F-35 pilot, you're not too worried about some former Eastern European country having the F-35 because they won't get all the cool gadgets that you've got?
Well, I have to chuckle a little bit, because one thing we didn't really talk about in the beginning is one of the coolest things I did in my time in the Marine Corps is they basically let me be a civilian for about a year and a half. And I went to Johns Hopkins and got a master's in international public policy. So essentially have this master's from Johns Hopkins in this international affairs environment, which I can't help but think about when you ask the question you had. So on top of all the cool things I did inside an airplane, I can't help but think about our relationship as a country with whole, with the rest of the world. And I guess the easiest way for me to answer that, because I've been given variations of this question before, is me personally, Dave Burke, former fighter pilot. I love the idea from a deterrent standpoint of any threat looking at us, America, and saying, if you're going to somehow initiate a war with America, you are now going to invoke the capability of an ever-growing list of countries that we can interact with in ways that they can't defend against. And so while I love the idea that I actually love the idea that the Raptor is so exclusive, I'm very proud to have flown that jet, and I'm super proud that we're the only ones flying it. I hope that is true forever, because the Raptor is an amazing airplane with some incredible capability. But if I put my I'm on the other side of the fence lens, and I'm thinking about provoking anybody in the F-35 ecosystem, and know that that provocation solicits a response by which, with essentially no effort compared to anything we've seen in the past, with such minimal effort that every F-35 community, every F-35 platform flying nation can leverage the capability of all of them, should give someone pause. Meaning, if I think I'm going to then provoke an F-35 flying country, and you can see that list has grown dramatically, and I think it's going to do nothing but get bigger. I think it serves as an incredible deterrent just globally in general. Because if you're a country looking at potentially provoking any of those nations, whoever they might be, and you've been alluded to former FSU, European, whatever, and I don't even know who's on the list right now, but if I just look at who might be on that list, your provocation of that country runs the risk of every other F-35 ecosystem nation being a participant in that provocation, or that response to that provocation. And if I was looking, I go, you know what? It might just be better if I leave this alone. I love the deterrent ability that's inherent in the F-35. It reminds me a little bit of how the F-16 was in the 80s, is that the more countries that had it, the easier it was for that country to get the support that it needed, if indeed it had to utilize that. And I think the F-16 did a really masterful job of really being available all over the world. So if you're flying around in an F-16 and you needed some help, maintenance help, a landing strip, you know, support, if you're in an F-16 friendly country, you're in a good spot. I'm certainly magnifying that, but the F-35 has created a global ecosystem of F-35 users that rely on each other and support each other, and certainly need each other to maximize their capability, but they're also all in it together to a certain degree. And I think that keeps anybody else from looking at it and going, is this person, is this country, is this potential threat in the F-35 world? I might want to think about just leaving them alone, because it runs the risk of everybody else that's reliant in inside that ecosystem. It might provoke them too. And from an international affairs standpoint, I think the more people involved in that world for our allies, the better.
You said earlier that there are some valid criticisms of F-35. What are they?
The first and most obvious ones to me was how late the airplane was, how expensive the airplane was compared to the promise of being affordable. And I forgot what the word of timely of when we were going to get it. There's some better vocabulary word for that, but when we were promised to receive it and how affordable it was. The criticism of it being not affordable and not delivered on time were 100% true. And I think what was that criticism was met with resistance, and I can't really explain exactly what that resistance was, but it was almost like a pushback against that criticism. Excuse me, sorry. And I think what it should have said was, those are totally valid criticisms. We, as a community, underestimated how hard this would be. We thought we could more quickly and more efficiently deliver on a capability that we had envisioned. And I think that the criticism should have been met with a response, which was, yes, we underestimated how hard this would be. I'm a huge defender of the F-35, because I'm a huge proponent of the platform. What I do know is that it is hard to overstate how revolutionary the airplane is. I mean, we are literally inventing technology and capability that have never existed, all doing it while trying to predict what the future might look like. And change is really hard. It's really hard, especially in a fiscally constrained environment. So you start talking about things like the sequestration and individual services having to make trade-offs. What the F-35 represented is probably one of the hardest things in the history of warfare, trying to figure out what does this thing need to do. And I think the gap between the promise and the reality in the beginning was significant enough that it should not have been met with resistance. It should have been met with acceptance, like, hey, these are fair criticisms. When you start getting into the criticisms of the what the airplane can do on behalf of the country, I think that's when you start to have the real challenge. Because, and I've said this many times, I'll keep this with me forever, is the farther away you are from the program, the more critical you are of it. Meaning, the less you know about the F-35, the more people criticize it, because they look at things like deficiency lists, and they look at things like initial test reports, and they look at things like FMC rates for the very first batch of jets, things like that are totally not relevant to the future capability of the platform. And they use it as a proof of a failure of a concept. The closer you are to the platform, the closer you are to the program, the more you understand about the plane, the more of an advocate you are. Which is why you could take any legacy fighter pilot who flew any amazing legacy platform, the Hornet, the Harrier, the A-10, the Eagle, the Strike Eagle, the Viper, and put them into an F-35. The longer they're in that plane, the more they would never go back to their legacy platform. You know, again, first 6 months, I grew up, my first love is the F-18. That's my first love. It always will be. Then I flew the Viper. I'm like, man, I wish I could have this much thrust in the Hornet. Man, I wish I could pull this many Gs. What a great view. And I was like, oh, who do I like better, the Hornet or the Viper? You start getting into the F-22 and then the F-35. And the longer you're in those platforms, the more you look back and think, man, if you're talking about going to war, and I had a choice between the F-18, the F-15, the F-16, and an F-35, I mean, I wouldn't waste a second contemplating it. The capability the F-35 brings from a warfare standpoint compared to anything else in the world is night and day. It's not even close. And the people closest to the platform understand that more and more and more, which is why the longer you've been flying it, the more you would never go back to anything else, at least when it comes to going to war, what war might look like, and even some of the most demanding environments. F-16's got a better view than the F-35 all day. It's got a better view. It is the most gorgeous view in the world. And if you were to ask me if I'm going to go to war on a Block 70 Viper or an F-35, I'm going to spend 0 seconds thinking about that question. You want to ask me if I'm going to go to war in an F-15EX or an F-35? I'm sorry, I'm going to spend zero time answering that question. The F-35 is undeniably, in the future of warfare, the only platform, because of the range of things it can do, who it can do it with, what it can provide, and where it can operate. There's nothing like it in the world. And the more you spend time in that, the more you understand that. That's why the advocacy for the airplane gets stronger and stronger the more people know about it, which is why these conversations are so important. I know we can't give everybody a clearance to tell you what's going on in that airplane, but the people that do know have an obligation to explain to the people that don't that their questions are valid, their criticisms are fair. We just have to give them an answer by which they go, oh, okay, that makes sense. And the advocacy can continue to grow. The criticism shouldn't be met with resistance. These are fair criticisms on behalf of people spending a ton of money who have their own defense in question. These people have a fair question to ask, and we have an obligation to answer it. And I say we because I still put myself in the corner of the uniformed service member. I'm now just a taxpayer. I guess I'm the other side of that discussion now, but I understand that platform enough to know that the people that are criticizing it, people are asking questions, they have a right to get good answers as best we can possibly give them, because they're the ones paying for it, and they're the ones who are going to be the beneficiary of the work that it does. So that criticism at the beginning, I wish we had handled that differently or a little bit differently. And I hope moving forward, we continue to take that criticism and go, fair question. Let me explain to you what I can so you better understand what it is that's going on here. Things like the deficiencies, the shortfalls, whatever those might be, we should answer those things as openly, as honestly as we can to help people understand it better.
Dave, how much time you got left?
I probably got 15,
Okay.
20. If I could stretch it 15, not quite 20, I'd say 20 minutes from now, I need to be saying
Okay,
goodbye.
that's fine, mate. Okay. Let me ask you one more sort of technical question then, in inverted commas, and then maybe we can change gears a little bit and actually talk about flying the aeroplane, because there will be some people who want to hear about flying the F-35B.
It's awesome. Let's talk about
it. All of those funny doors that open up and the lift fan and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. But so let me ask you one more question just on this thread then. I noticed when you talked 10 minutes or so ago, you said there's no other aeroplane you'd like to be in that gives you the situational awareness where you can see them and they can't see you. So there's sort of two parts to the equation, I suppose. Is it a silly question to ask whether you could take all the sensors and all the stuff that gives you the SA in the F-35 and put it into something like an F-15EX, so you get 50% of that capability, and you would it be practical? I mean, so you're not an engineer, you're an aviator, but you know, yeah. if you could do it, would it be worth doing it? Would do you need the full equation to be effective? You have to have the LO and the sensor fusion and situational awareness.
Without question, it is all the different attributes have to be built in from the ground up. It's almost like, I've never come up with a good analogy. If you think of your iPhone, I don't know if you're an iPhone user. I'll say you're an iPhone user, just for argument's sake. And inside that, you have all these different capabilities. You can figure out what the weather is going to be. You can see what's going on with the stock market. If you want, you can actually buy some food on that thing, or buy some clothes or something, have it delivered to you. You can also get directions. You can figure out exactly where you are. You can, all this information is readily available to you, not just because of the uniqueness of the hardware itself, that physical machine called an iPhone, but more importantly, because of the application ecosystem that sits inside of that did not exist before the iPhone, meaning the ability to order food and then get real-time traffic. Because some app developer said, oh, your platform, I could take my software and stick it on your hardware, and these things would work seamlessly together. If you had an older generation phone and you wanted to get GPS information, it might have like a little port on this. Like, oh, I could buy this little GPS, I could stick it on there. Man, I get the same information you got in your phone. That's 100% true. But you can see where I'm going with this. The F-35 isn't just unique because it's stealthy. The F-35 isn't unique just because it has sensor fusion. The F-35 isn't just unique, but because it has multiple spectrum transmit and receive capability. The F-35 isn't unique because it has a fully optimized cockpit. The F-35 isn't unique because it's got the ability to see through the skin of the plane with your distributed aperture system. The F-35 is unique because it incorporates all that information together and then shares that in a way that all the other airplanes inside this ecosystem benefit from that. The compulsion to look at things like, could it be faster? Well, I mean, yeah, it could, I guess. I don't know why you'd want it to be faster. I don't know what I would do in a plane that goes Mach 1.6 versus a plane that goes Mach 2.0. I've been in planes that go Mach 2. I've been Mach 2. I don't know what happens in the regime by which we could. Would I like it to do more than 7.5 Gs? I mean, I guess. I flew Hornets, which on paper says 7.5 Gs. Actually, it's not true. Any Hornet pilot in the world will tell you it is an 8.1 G platform. We all know that. And the F-16 was a 9 G platform. And actually, if you did it perfectly in an F-16, you'd get 9.1. That's what the computer would give you. That 1 G is nice, but I can't imagine being in a situation that said the difference between my success and my failure was that one attribute, that one variation. To try to create a legacy machine to replicate what the F-35 is doing by trying to connect those other things, reducing the signature, adding a sensor or a module, I think what you're giving up is the uniqueness of the F-35 is the integration, the seamless integration of all those capabilities inside one platform by design. And I think it's that attribute that makes it so inherently flexible, so inherently adjustable, so inherently adaptable to the future. And then again, retains the unique attributes that says, the threat does not dictate to us whether or not we can go fly. I don't ever want to be in a plane that has, even if it has amazing capability, that goes, oh, I see you, which means I can shoot you, which means I can kill you, which means I can keep you from getting airborne. Why would we want to hand that ability over to our threats? Why would we want to let them dictate to us? And so it's not just any one individual thing. It's the connection of all those things in one single platform. And that's why there is nothing like the F-35 in the world. There's nothing like it. It touches and overlaps everything we just talked about earlier today. the electronic warfare, electronic attack, electronic prevention, protection, sensor fusion, incredibly maneuverable capability, long loiter times, a great suite of weapons, flies in almost austere environments off ships, off land, and small runways, off carriers, and then has inherent low observable capability, and not just all variations of low observability, and it's all in one single platform flown by a single pilot that touches now dozens of different countries around the world for a natural deterrent capability. I don't know what the appeal would be for anything else. Or I shouldn't say that. I disagree with the logic that says something else is a better alternative based on my experience. Okay. And that's not to say anything. I think the F-15 is like the coolest, awesome. The F-16 is awesome. The F-18 is awesome. But if you're asking me what I'm going to go to war in, come on, man. It's not even close. It's not even close. Keep your extra G and a half. Keep your extra 200 knots. I'll take all these other attributes that really make the airplane unique that is not replicable by just sticking on different components of those capabilities on other machines.
Tell us about flying it then. So one thing, I mean, I think everybody listening to this will know the F-35B is the V-stall variant. So what's it like to fly? And what's it like, specifically the question I have is, what's it like in that transition phase when, you know, when all those sort of the lift fan door opens and the jet exhaust tilts down? Do you feel rumbling? What's it like?
Yeah, you feel everything. The F-35 to me was a real treat because, listen, when you're up and away, and we even use that term up and away in the F-35B, is like all the doors are closed, you're a regular jet. Up and away flying in all those planes I told you about, Hornet, Viper, 22, F-35, just normal transiting flying around the world, they're very similar. They feel very similar. They sound very similar. They interact very similarly. You know, it's funny, for having flown more time in the Hornet than anything else, I flew three side stick jets, you know, the Viper, the F-22, and F-35 are all super intuitive, super easy to fly, super fun, just a blast for the most part, great views, just flying fighters in general. I highly recommend it for anybody that can do it. Go fly fighters. It's a super cool experience. The F-35B, certainly when you get into this really unique Stovall mode, that's to me is where it was an experience I'd never had elsewhere. And only other community they had that was the Harrier community. And my recollection, because I had when I was commanded the very first squadron, I had members of the Hornet community, the Harrier community, and all these different sub-communities in aviation. What the Harrier community would tell you, especially when we're talking about vertical landing at ship or in very small runway complexes, you know, not full-size runways, or little landing pads, landing vertically in that Stovall mode, that vertical landing mode, is really, really hard. And it's really, really high demand on the pilot, meaning you are busy, very small margins for error, time crunches, you know, limitations of all sorts of different pressing on you that you really can't, you can't deviate from optimal very much before you get into catastrophic scenarios. And the Harrier's a really hard plane to fly vertically and land vertically. The first time I converted to Stovall mode, you literally just press a button, it's a Stovall button, the doors, and it's like, and it rumbles and it's loud and it kind of feels a little bit weird. The very first time I did that coming in, it was at Eglin Air Force Base in my first vertical landing. The very first time I'd ever done it in my entire life, when I flew over the pad, my mom had come out in the truck that were the landing officer, the landing signals officer down there. She came with him, was sitting in there. In my very first vertical landing of the F-35, I was able to look over with no hands and wave to my mom during the descent onto the landing pad. Now, that probably wasn't the smartest thing for me to do, but the ease with which that plane took me from a conventional high-performance fighter to a vertical landing machine into this tiny little landing area was remarkable. It was remarkable. And what was remarkable was how easy it was. Almost so that if you told the Harrier guys back then, they're almost annoyed it was so easy. Now, they weren't annoyed because they knew it was going to save lives and save airplanes. It's going to save lives and save machines. But there's a part of them saying, hey, that's almost cheating. You're cheating in this thing. It's so easy to fly. And that's actually true for all the airplanes. But when you think about the B variant, you think where it was really the most high demand is in the most challenging of environments, which is vertical landing. I cannot tell you how shocking was how easy that was in a relatively early software suite too. It's just gotten better from that, from a pilot relief standpoint. the engineers did something remarkable that I don't think I fully appreciated. So the first time I did my first VL in the F-35, I'm like, this is so easy. I don't have to do anything. I can look and wave at my mom, which I literally have on camera, by the way. It was a remarkable experience. Flying that thing was a blast. It was so fun. And the very first time you do you turn on the DAS and you look through the airplane, I'm like, this is bizarre, you know, being able to look through the airplane and see things that you haven't seen before. It takes very little getting used to with the helmet, no HUD. You adapt to that thing in a matter of minutes. Even on the first flight, you start to figure things out. It's a super intuitive plane and a blast to fly. It's a lot of fun.
In that VL mode then, is it correct that the throttle and the stick change behaviors? So the throttle pushing it forward means you scoot forward, pulling it back means you comes back, and then stick forward is go down and stick back is come up. Is that correct?
Yeah. It's A, yes, and B, just for your, it is super intuitive. There is very little thought in your mind because pushing forward on the stick still makes you go down.
Yeah.
Pulling back on the stick still makes you go up. The rudder pedals still make your nose move, but when you're in that landing mode, that vertical, that Stovall mode, that mode four of the jet that's doing the down recovery. And so all the movement of the stick and throttle is super intuitive. But yes, if you want to go forward, you push forward on the throttle, which is like you're accelerating. And if you want to go down, you push forward on the stick.
And so when you're in a hover and you want to fly away, up and away, I think you said you called it. So you press the button and the aeroplane accelerates itself in level flight forwards. And then once it's done it, you take over, or can you fly it when it's sort of between modes, when it's transitioning
from
one to the other?
There is an absolute transition period. I'd have to go back and recall my manual recollection of how it converts from mode one to mode four and back and forth. There is a transition period there. And, you know, sometimes you're using the landing gear up and down. So there's a transition period. But in the end, when you're going to get out of that stowable mode where you're hovering, you literally accelerate, start going forward. You pull back in the stick to raise the nose up. You raise up the gear, and then you convert out of the stowable mode, the mode four. And in that whole period, with very little effort from the pilot other than just letting it do what it's supposed to do, it cleans up into its normal up and away mode, and you fly away. Like I said, it may sound more, I may be making it sound more complicated than it is. And mechanically, it's very complicated going on behind you. But from the cockpit, it's super easy, man. It's super simple and straightforward. The pilot relief is the term that we use. The pilot relief that's been created by that software and the Stovall is unreal. It's so good.
Sounds phenomenal.
It's awesome. It's so fun.
Well, Dave, we are out of time, and I need to let you go because you have other obligations. I did say to you before we hit recording that I wasn't going to sort of try to do any gotchas, but I've got one question for you that you definitely are not going to be expecting. I was reading today that the Marine Corps has declared an ace, an AV-8B ace, a pilot who shot down 7 Houthi drones. My question is that legit? Does shooting down drones count as becoming an ace? There you go.
So first is, I hadn't heard that. So I'm literally going to get off this call and I'm going to Google that story just so I can even just get some context for that. And two is, if I was that guy, I'd love to be an ace too. So I'm going to just say, like, let him enjoy his moment and let the rest of the world decide whether it's legitimate or not. That's a very interesting story that I haven't heard. So I got to go Google that. I didn't know that was even the case.
It is very, very evident in your answers that you now teach leadership and diplomacy. You should add to your list. Okay.
There you go.
David, it's been a joy talking to you, listening to you, share your experiences. We're really, really grateful to you. So thanks for joining us here at Authentic Media, and look forward to speaking to you again at some point in the future too.
Same here. I appreciate the questions. You should reach out anytime. Ask me any question you want. I'll do my best to give you my version of that question and give you my perspective anytime.
Thanks, Dave.